Hi, everyone. Welcome to Design Development, brought to you by H&O Structural Engineering. This is your hub to learn direct from top performers in real estate development, design, and construction. I'm your host, Renz Hayes, co-founder of H&O, lifelong learner, and I'm obsessed with high-powered organizations and the leaders that guide them. If this is your first time listening, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, I can't thank you enough. Let's go. We have an exciting guest for today's episode of Design Development. It's my pleasure to introduce Krista Van Rantz. She is the founder of Building People. Krista started off in event planning and quickly found herself into learning and development at Suffolk Construction, and that set her off on this career path. She now does outsourced learning and development programs. She helps with grant writing, and this is a really important conversation, and it's one I'm passionate about. A big oversight in a lot of organizations is the importance of giving learning and development opportunities to their team and helping them build the competencies to ultimately be successful in their roles and their future roles, and help the company continue to grow. Krista's team has a ton of resources on their website, and she's really has a lot to contribute to the conversation. So it's my pleasure to share that conversation with you today. And without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Krista Van Rantz. Please join me in welcoming Krista Van Rantz. Krista, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Renz.
This is a big conversation around learning in development, something I am passionate about, and I know you share that. You're probably more passionate about it than I am. For those that don't know you, could you introduce Building People?
Yeah. So Building People was started in 2020, not knowing that the world was going to end. And we focus on helping small and medium-sized businesses get training funds through training grants, which we'll chat about later, to provide training for their folks. We help small and medium-sized construction businesses, or specifically in the AEC industry, with outsourced learning and development opportunities. They maybe don't need a full-time person, but know how important it is from a cultural perspective to focus on learning. And then lastly, we help HR folks who know how important a lot of the learning and organizational development aspects are, but don't even know where to start or to begin.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenging world to understand and see how it influences organizational results and team building. What is the actual objective of learning and development when done well? I think a lot of business leaders get this wrong as they look at it as a cost. And they hope that their team is able to just learn on the job and figure out what to do, and that they understand what the owner's thinking. But at the end of the day, like, learning and development's really an investment, isn't it?
Yeah. I think especially in small and medium-sized businesses, right, that a lot of leaders, owners of those businesses are still very much focused on the business, on working in the business, and making sure that the sales are coming in, that the business development is working, and that the overall operations are being managed. I think less time ends up being spent on the actual people side of things. And I think it's really important that when you do spend some of that time in creating processes, making sure folks are learning, understanding and giving ownership to those pieces, that folks often will end up wanting, they'll be more loyal to you, they'll want to continue working, growing themselves. They might come up with new ideas that didn't exist before and ways to better the business overall. So oftentimes, as long as you can do it right, you can measure the success, even if it's in saving the business money versus making it money.
Well said. I like how you set the stage there, especially for small business owners that are still working in the business. I think when people refer to working on the business, what we're really talking about is the strategy and the direction of the business, coupled with how are we building our people. That's really the big pivot.
And I think, you know, so many folks, yourself included, although you are very passionate in that space, but a lot of small businesses are like, I want to focus on my people. I just don't even know where to start. And if I build out a list, it's a mile long and I haven't gotten any.
And you're serving the AE space. And are you typically working with small businesses, medium-sized businesses, large businesses? Who do you serve?
Yeah. From an outsourced learning and development perspective, we try and focus on businesses that are probably under 150 employees. Feeling like if it's over 150, they probably need more resources than we may be able to provide. Whereas from a training grant perspective, we've worked with companies of all sizes, even outside of the AEC industries, in in music and hospitality and all of that.
Learning and development's a little bit more than lunch and learns, right?
A little bit.
I think sometimes this gets overlooked that people are checking the box on learning and development. Like we have a monthly tech talk or we have lunch and learns, but those aren't necessarily catered to the business leads and building the skills necessary to grow a company. So for those small businesses or people recognizing we need to get serious about learning and development for our team, where does a company start?
It's a great question. I think a lot of times it's a great place to look inward and understand what are our business goals? What pain points do we have? What does the culture currently look like and what do we want it to look like? There is this triangle. It is always shapes with theories, right? And so one of the theories is the dimensions of success. And it's an equilateral triangle with the idea that you need to be successful, teams need to focus equally, very important piece there, equally on the goals or the results. They need to focus equally on the relationships and they need to focus equally on the processes. And I think so often, right, if we're thinking about those small businesses, there's such a huge push to make sure that we're getting to those goals or results. And there's less of a focus on the relationships and the processes. And usually then people tend to go towards the processes and the relationships are hit last, whereas our organization is built around the fact of if you can continue to build relationships with folks and really care about one another, you know, you can probably achieve those other pieces.
I like the mental model of that equilateral triangle, the goals, the relationships and the processes. I think for anyone out there that's evaluating their current state of their business, that's a pretty easy mental model to apply to your business to see like, where are we falling down? Where are we strongest? I learned from the CVGA program and Ken Sanginario is a brilliant mind in business, a brilliant leader. And he talks about qualitative versus quantitative. And it's easy, especially for small business owners in the business to focus on the goals. Right? Because they figure out the other stuff and they have intuition on what they personally want, but they struggle to convey it. And they focus on the quantitative, which can actually adversely hurt the company. It's figuring out what qualitative factors, the relationships and processes that we use to achieve our goals can really be the unlock for our business.
And that equilateral part, right? If you focus too much on the goals, that triangle then becomes, my children would say, I think obtruse is the technical term for that triangle, you know, and then you can't focus. You don't have enough time or energy to focus as much on the relationships or the process.
And I applaud you for also having the perspective. I asked the question, you started off with understanding what is the objectives and the goals of the company, their mission, vision, values, those sort of things. Because sometimes there can be the stigma of the people that are so focused on the people and the culture and the environment, they don't understand how to drive business results. But in a healthy organization, one is driving the other. So it's a really important relationship. And I applaud you for connecting those dots. Can you talk to us about the challenges the construction industry? I know you have experience there. You serve them currently at Building People. What are they facing right now with an aging workforce? And how can L&D help them solve that problem?
Yeah, we have two clients who I would say more than 20% of their employees are 65 plus and are like any day could say, you know what, I'm hanging up the hat.
20% of their workforce.
20% of their workforce, yeah. And both of those organizations also have high growth plans. One of them is hoping to grow 21% year over year for the next 5 years. And one of the other is at least hoping to grow by 10%. And so if you think about, okay, all of like these folks are potentially leaving the workforce. And in addition to that, we also have to grow that workforce. Where can you find them? And how can you tap into the knowledge that the folks who have been there for 40 years have and utilize that to the best of your ability while also acknowledging that there are probably going to be some new folks coming in? And so I think like one of those challenges, right, is like, are there opportunities to slowly transition folks out rather than that drastic, I was working full time and now I'm retired? I think folks that are in this industry love, they're very passionate about this industry. They joined this industry for that reason. And the idea of just like cutting it short isn't always the case, and that's okay. But can you provide them with like, hey, we're going to have a couple of new folks come in, and when they do, we'd love for you to meet with them once a month to walk the job site and share some of your knowledge and like tidbits of information.
Yeah. And so how do we create a system? How do we create a process to get all of the knowledge out of those, let's call them the legacy, the people that have been there, done that for the last 40 years? How do we transition that knowledge to the new workforce?
Yeah.
Is there a difference between, we talk about learning and development. Do you look at those two terms as meaning different things? How do they relate to each other?
Yeah. So we've chatted about this before, and I think even on LinkedIn, learning and development, it is almost short. So there's oftentimes people will call it training. My feeling on training is that it is a one and done workshop. That's just the terminology, the way that I perceive it. Learning, I think, has the potential to be a series of opportunities in which you would learn. But then the development side actually is shortened for organizational development and how the broader company is thinking about developing its folks, its company, the succession planning, and ideally its culture. So I think the development side, there's a lot more behind the scenes back end work that is going on in hopes of improving the overall culture, mindset, and company growth. Whereas the learning piece is probably the things that people see regularly, which may include some of those lunch and learns you brought up at the beginning.
I like the definition, how I've always thought of training and development is training is used to develop the skills and competencies to do your job today. Development is used to develop the skills to do the job of the future you. But I like your pivot on learning, because I think training does come with this indication that you can complete training somehow. But in reality, learning is a forever process if we're doing it right. You want to be a lifelong learner. It's something I'm super passionate about. So I love the term. At Building People, you guys are outsourced L&D. Are you providing out-of-the-box programs? Are you customizing them for each client? How do you service these clients?
Yeah, great question. So we'll come in, we'll understand those overall business needs, and it will be, for the most part, customized to that client. So some of them are saying, hey, we need to hire some more folks. And we ask the question of like, how long does it currently take you to onboard a new employee and get them up to speed at the efficiency that you have some of your other employees? And a lot of folks will say probably 9 to 12 months in reality. It's a lot of time for the rest of the team to be able to pick up some of those pieces. It's a lot of time from leadership. So we're trying to think through, okay, what, even like, let's scale a bunch of this. Let's make their first 2 weeks crazy busy versus slow, but let's offer them the opportunity to meet with so many different people to provide a real context of what the organization and culture is like, give them as much information as possible so that they are able to start asking questions right from the beginning. I'd rather give a lot of information to folks so that they have more questions to be able to get answered versus waiting, slowly giving them the information for them to slowly begin asking questions.
Do you find a lot of companies have an onboarding program, like an actual process that people go through? And that's at any scale, like from small, mid to large, like you're seeing that generally as a deficiency in organizations.
Yes. I would say that if you ask them, they will tell you that they have one. And what they mean by that is that they have the first day is all planned out for you, that you're going to meet with HR, which I'm technically in that space. And I can't say that it's the most exciting of things and ways to get people stoked about your company. You're going to, you know, like make sure that you're going to meet with IT if you have one, or an IT consultant to get your IT set up. And you might do an office tour, you know, like they're going to check a bunch of these boxes, but they're not really going to extend it past that first day.
And then it becomes on the job learning.
Yes.
So out of the box, onboarding, customizable, do you have done for you, done with you, done by you solutions? How do you think about these problems?
Yeah. So we have a new manager program. We have a full-time facilitator in-house that facilitates with a bunch of different clients, all once again within the AEC industries. And when, if you are one of our clients, then you get some of that as part of our program. If not, then we also do those programs for other organizations that are not a retainer client of ours. So that's kind of that done for you perspective. We'll obviously customize whatever needs that they have around new manager training, but a lot of it, we're able to kind of take it and run with it. Additionally, from a, once again, outsourced learning and development, we have companies that are like, hey, we need to do a better training on Bluebeam or Procore or some of our technologies. We can always bring vendors in and have those vendors teach it. It's something that would be that it's, it allows for a faster turnaround, but there is an expense. Whereas instead, we can also offer to teach some of your internal experts to train on that. And we will work with them to build out an outline. We will draft up the content, maybe some sample exercises in there from a Bluebeam perspective, right? That we've got some different drawings in there. And then we'll do a dry run to make sure that they have a chance to practice it beforehand. So that is where it's kind of the do it with you, because we do need the experts to be able to help us in that regard.
That's a good example. If I think back to even my time in the steel world, there is training that's required that we felt we couldn't get from an outside company that provides training sources. It was internal knowledge, internal processes, and we had to figure out a way. So that's something your team helps extract that industry expertise and create development programs with their team. That's it done with you.
I mean, one of the things that we do, but by all means, like you can easily do as well, is in creating processes, right? We're talking about small businesses. They often don't have a bunch of processes drafted, prepared, prepped to share with a random new employee that comes in. So we would meet with one of the experts for an hour. We'd record that whole meeting. Then we would send it to this AI transcription tool, because there's so many now, which is amazing. We send it to Rev. They transcribe the entire meeting in the matter of minutes for about $7. Maybe it's a little bit more, but it's not too expensive. And then we're able to take that and put it into our kind of overall SOP or process template and then fill in the holes from there.
For anyone struggling with creating processes, something that helps, that has helped me in the past, it's literally just documenting a decision tree. If you can just start to document what decisions have to be made in chronological order, if you can, that's going to provide the rough outline. So even if it's incomplete, like start somewhere like that, just to start getting these ideas in a process.
Yeah. And that's going to give you the template, like the steps. The other thing that I think is really important is understanding what the definition of success for that overall process is going to be. Because you may have someone more junior, less experienced, out of the industry completely, and they're going to complete the tasks, but they're going to have no idea what that success looks like. And it could end up going in a different direction than you may want or hope.
Very, very good point. I think that that's often overlooked in quality management of even, say, technical documents or technical execution. People think someone senior overseeing a junior person doing their work is quality control. But if there aren't established standards for them to check against or processes to check against, it's not really quality control. Quality assurance is making sure somebody followed the process and executed the job to the standards that were deemed important by the company, right? And you're applying that to learning and development. I think it's awesome. What types of resources are available to companies looking to invest in L&D? You mentioned grant writing. Tell us about that process.
Yeah. So there are training grants, funding that organizations can apply to in every state across in the U.S. I don't know about countries outside of the U.S. Every single state. So here in Massachusetts, a company of 60 something, like 63 people, could ask for up to $200,000 to train their people over a 2-year time frame. In New York City, companies can ask for up to $400,000, depending on the number of folks. And in California, it's $500,000. Most states are around the $100,000 mark, but still, that is a substantial amount of money to be able to utilize. And the reason they all exist is that they are a form of proactive unemployment. And what I mean by that is that reactive unemployment, right? Someone is laid off and the economy around them needs to continue to exist, at least from the government's perspective. So they say, you know what? They're going to still receive some sort of check so that the economy around them can continue to exist. From a proactive perspective, the government says, but you know what? That doesn't seem like the only approach. And so we're going to take some of those unemployment dollars that you all are paying into, and we're going to set them aside for a different approach or a different fund. And that is in these training grant funds. And what the government is saying is, hey, if we provide training to companies, one of three things will happen that will affect the unemployment. One, that person will still get laid off. The person that you hoped to have training for will still get laid off. However, now they will have additional skills to ideally get a job somewhere else more quickly and not be on unemployment as long as maybe they had prior to having those skills. The second one is that that person will learn those skills, not get laid off, and the company will continue to utilize the employees that they have. And the third and best option from the government's perspective is that the company will do so well with those new skills, the people will become more productive and efficient, and they will grow the company, hiring more people, thus, in the concept, reducing unemployment.
This is a government program I can get behind. It almost makes too much sense.
Yes. Yes, there is. It's money you're already paying into, so you might as well take advantage of it.
And so your team specializes and understands these grant programs and how they're allocated. What generally are they looking for from, if we use Massachusetts as an example, what is Massachusetts looking for from contribution from the company?
Massachusetts is a one-to-one contribution. So as long as you are paying, you have to pay your folks a salary while they are trained. And that is a question that we get a lot, right? Because there are folks that in the trades are like, our people are pretty expensive. And if we're not going to have them out doing the work, you know, how are we going to be able to afford this training? And these training grants are a great opportunity at that. So you still have to pay their salary in these industries. Often that is all you need to do. And the training will be covered by paying for your folks to go through training. Some of the things that they here in Massachusetts like to see, they like to see English as a second language. They love to see basic computer skills. Anything that is taking the lowest paid employees and providing them an opportunity to be paid more or to have additional skills, that's big. They don't love one-on-one executive coaching, right? They're like, hey, you know what? That's great for that person. And I can see overall how it would be have advantages to your company. But that person, if they were laid off, would probably easily find a spot somewhere else. They have a slew of skills. They don't need additional skills. And there's a cost associated.
Yeah, you can understand why the government doesn't feel the need to allocate capital to that executive, that one executive.
Yeah.
What is building a top-tier learning culture to you?
Ooh, good question. I think it's creating, and I think I have three C's. Let me just make sure that I do. That, you know, it's one where people are curious. They're collaborative and they're coachable.
Curious, collaborative, coachable. I love those.
Yeah. And being okay with that curiosity. I remember seeing you, and I know that you're a big fan of the Great Game of Business, something like that. And an open book finances, right? And I think people sometimes get curious about like, oh, it looks like we're making all this money. How come I am not getting more? How come I'm not getting paid more? And some people start maybe like side skirting around those questions and asking that. And leaders who are going to kind of shove down that curiosity are going to be like, I promise you we're not making like as much as you think. Like, don't worry about that question and get back to work. Whereas if folks are curious and you can share something, you don't need to share everyone's individual salaries. But I think oftentimes in sharing and continuing to allow for that curiosity to exist and sharing what information you can. One, once again, as small businesses know, most of them aren't raking it in and just living on and planning to buy their next yacht. There are a lot of expenses that come into play. And when you're able to share in this example with those curious employees where things are going, they have a huge respect. And also they start to get curious of like, how can I make the company more money? Because I think that may end up helping me.
Absolutely. This to me sounds like more like it's explaining what a growth mindset is, right?
Yes.
I'm a huge advocate for pushing towards a growth mindset and being aware of what does a scarcity mindset look like and what are the kind of the adverse effects of having a scarce mindset. And to your point, a lot of people are hidden and they're in the dark relative to organizational financials. And there's plenty of people in this country that are wondering why they can't move their career forward or why they're not getting the promotion. And what they might not be aware of is that the company's not doing that great financially. So it has nothing to do necessarily with their individual performance, that there is other roadblocks. And I think exposing yourself to that way of thinking will help you identify problems at a totally different way.
That was obviously one example, right? But like, I love the people that are like, hey, I'm kind of curious about ChatGPT and what it could potentially do for our company. Is this something I can look into, right? If you're a leader and you hear one of your folks is curious about trying something new and they're kind of asking for permission to spend a little bit of time researching and learning more, win-win.
Curious and coachable, I think those are two things that come into, especially curious, is someone that can manage conflict as well, whether that's internal or external. If you go into any type of conflict thinking you have the answers and that the other person's out to get you, like you're going to generally come with the wrong tone. But if you enter those conversations with curiosity and seeking to understand, you're going to find a better way forward.
And that was that third C was collaborative, right? And I think especially in this industry, but if I mean, I've had to learn the lesson myself. I was so sure I could do everything all on my own, but definitely cannot.
You studied marketing and management at University of Albany. What did you think your career would look like?
And I think you saw this in my LinkedIn bio, that I worked full-time senior year of college for a wedding planner, a special events company. And I very much was in thinking that I was going to be managing huge events and like concerts and the sort. That was where I thought my world was going.
You were passionate about that. That's the direction you thought you were going to go.
That was the direction.
And how did you find your way into the construction industry?
Moved to Boston on a whim with two close friends from home. I'm originally from upstate New York. So I moved to the big city of Boston and will truly never forget driving up, you know, out of the underground tunnels and like looking up and thinking all of these buildings are so big and I can't believe I get to live in this big city, which is now so small. But we kind of moved here on a whim and needed a job and worked at a bunch of different places. I got a job at Suffolk. I interviewed there and I thought to myself, I'll work in learning and development for a year and then I'll hopefully get it to transition over to their marketing department.
And the rest is history. You just saw an opening for a learning development team and saw that there was a correlation. It was a way to get into a good company.
Yeah, from a coordination perspective, I knew I could manage different events and had done some of that. And so I could probably coordinate those events appropriately. And it was a good company. But I knew nothing about construction. Nothing other than like the average layperson of like they're making the traffic worse, right? That's all I knew about construction at the time. And I've learned so, so much and have such a higher respect and appreciation for it now.
Tell us about some of the things you worked on while you were at Suffolk.
Yeah. We were big on building a lot of the content internally in-house. So working with subject matter experts, we had John is a huge believer in learning and development. And so we had a team of seven, I think, in learning and development when I started, which was pretty substantial for a company that was around 700 people at the time. We had full-on career development curriculum. So if you were a certain role, there were certain programs that you had to go through each year. There was obviously the Career Start program, which is a two-year rotational program for new college grads to come in and learn the three main aspects of construction. It's estimating, project management, and superintendent roles.
That Career Jumpstart program is like a staple of stuff at construction. You were involved in creating that? That's pretty cool.
I was not involved in creating that one. That one already existed when I was there. I was involved in creating the one at Delbrook.
in that career jumpstart. So the premise there is they get two-year program and they're exposed to all three facets of the business, the field, estimating, and management. Is that what it was?
And project management. Yeah, there were at Suffolk, we had a couple of different ones that, like, a few folks, I think, went into business development. A few folks, I think, helped John with a lot of his things. So that was a really great opportunity. I know Shamit has a program, and one of their cohorts is, I think, in around marketing or maybe some of the in-house aspects. So a lot of these companies have realized the value in providing people with different opportunities to see where their right fit is. And there's a few folks that I've seen go through these careers, and I thought for sure they were going to end up in project management. I loved estimating. And it's one of those things that, if a lot of times people don't get that opportunity to try out a couple of different options.
That's where I think there's conversation around, you got to follow your passion, but if you haven't tried anything, you don't really know what you're passionate about. So you got to have this period of curiosity to figure that out.
And it's, I hate to say, you can do it whenever and any time in your life, but there, the hard part is that you're sometimes shackled by those golden handcuffs, right? That you've gotten to a point where you're making a certain amount of money, and to transition to try something else out that you think you'd be more passionate in will have a cost to your personal wallet. And a lot of folks aren't ready or willing to commit to that.
That's a tough decision to make. You're right. There's an internal battle there. It's like, am I happy in what I do? Am I happy enough with the income that I have to do the things outside of work that I love and provide for my family? Versus, like, how do I reposition my career to become more fulfilled and lead in a greater direction? I don't know that, I think we could probably talk for an entire podcast on that one conversation, but I'm definitely passionate about people being vocal. Like, be vocal in your views on the things that you're happy about and not happy about in your job. Be aware of where you provide value to the company currently, and just communicate, like, I want a period of my time here to be able to focus and work on new skills. I'll keep being productive on this other period, but you got to give me space in my day.
100%. 100%.
Quick break from the show. Thanks for tuning in to Design Development. We're trying to help as many people as possible. So if you could subscribe and leave a review on today's episode on whatever platform you're listening, it would be a great help. It's the only way we're going to reach more people. Let's get back to the show. How do you organize and track learning and development in a large organization? You worked with some big companies. We're going to get to more of that. But are you using a software? Like, where, how do you track who's done what? Like, this can't be in one big Excel spreadsheet.
I mean, most of the systems are, at the end of the day, a one big Excel spreadsheet. So there are a lot of learning management systems that exist out there. They definitely have more value in larger organizations. You can upload a lot of those videos and track completions and all that type of metrics and measurements. Then you can make sure that people's certifications are updated. If you think about, like, a construction supervisor's license, you need to renew that every 2 years. And so it's one of those things that could easily fall to the wayside. And having a system to be able to track that and remind you as the administrator or remind the individual that it's coming due is a huge, huge help. However, at the end of the day, you also then have another system in play. And so with a lot of small and medium-sized businesses, I almost don't think it makes sense. There's plenty of clients that we have where we do just track it on an Excel file. There are other clients that we have that, I think we've chatted about this before as well, that use Trainual, whereas it's like this kind of middle of the line, not super expensive, easy to use system to be able to track, you know, what folks have gone through, what certifications that they need, any new processes. You can update those in real time and make sure that everyone gets access to those updates.
That's right. That's Trainual is the thing we use. That's the system we use at H&O. And it's definitely been a great software, a great transition for us. It's not an all-in-one, like, manage all of your learning and development, but it does optimize training, onboarding, that sort of thing. If I were to share the problems that we were trying to solve, is you start to grow and onboard people. And we had different people doing different training as a part of this onboard experience. We do have, like, a framework and a multi-week. We have a plan for them over the first 90 90 days and check in. And then all of a sudden, someone's busy, someone's on vacation, and then you start to have a different experience for each person that joins your company, and now it's kind of falling apart. So you have to find a way to create consistency across like your onboarding and training. That's what Trainual allowed us to do.
Yes, 100%.
As we go through, we start to create all this video training and this experience, consistent experience for people to go through in training. How do you still keep the personal touch? Like, how do you advise your clients? Like, there's the efficiency side of creating all this video training, but now you don't want to shove somebody in front of a computer and say, watch 2 weeks of videos and then come talk to us. Like, how do you balance that?
From a new employee perspective, I'm a big believer in having a lot. Like, I know some clients don't love meetings. I know nobody loves meetings, if we're honest. But I do think that that one-to-one true interaction is really, really helpful. Couple of options. There's this concept called a flipped classroom, where if folks, one, I know you're going to ask me this question, so I'm prepped for it. One of my favorite books is Unreasonable Hospitality, and it's about like a gentleman that had the number one restaurant in the world wrote a book about how he kind of got to that place and how you can think about that in your own, in any culture, in any industry. And I'm just on a big kick on that right now, of like, how can you make the employee experience kind of like a customer experience and a luxury customer experience at that, right? Like, what would that look like? I promise you it wouldn't look like a bunch of videos that someone has to sit and watch on day one, right? On day one, I often say that when a new employee comes to work, it is not the best day of their life. And ideally, if you do it right, it's also not the worst day of their life. But most people are probably somewhere in the middle. They're coming in, they're tentative. And so they're coming in at a 5 out of 10, scale out of 10. You, as the organization and the leader, has the opportunity to scale that up or scale that down pretty quickly. And scaling it down pretty quickly, to me, looks like putting you in your cubicle that you don't even have any sort of connection with yet, and having you watch 6 hours of video. Whereas instead, ratcheting that up, it might be having lunch with the CEO on day one. And the fact that there's like a plan of a bunch of different people to meet that they customized specifically for you and spent time and attention on you before you even got there.
Yeah, love that perspective. And I think even providing the scale of expectations, that 5 out of 10 number, it doesn't take much to beat a 5. A little bit can go a long way to an experience is expectations minus reality. So you make a reality a little bit better, you win on the experience game. And that's a first impression that employee has for the future of that company, right?
Yeah. Now, I will say that there's some, from a scalability perspective, right? Those videos do come in handy. And there is this concept of a flipped classroom approach where, when is the right time for those videos? I can't answer that. That's dependent on each company and each culture. But if the opportunity arises that there are those videos, having it where the person watches the video and then finds a time to check in with the person who created it or their manager or whomever to ask any questions that they have garnered from that information to kind of bring it to life and make it more real.
Your career took a brief pivot outside of construction to TripAdvisor. Can you tell us about this opportunity and what excited you to go give this a shot?
So my boss, who was at Suffolk, left Suffolk and went over to TripAdvisor. And I may have gotten a call 6 months later to join him. And I wasn't sure what that was going to look like. But what was enticing was that it was a new department. And he had started the department. And I was going to have the opportunity to help roll out learning and development globally. And within the first month there, I had a chance to fly to London and to their London office. And so it felt really, really exciting to switch over to a global organization, a tech space. It was there's a lot of those like sparkly, shiny things that you see right at the beginning.
That's such a unique opportunity. I think I read at the time, is it 1,700 employees?
I think it was 1,700 employees when I started, and I left, and I think it was around 3,500. So they doubled in size in about 4 years, and not a small doubling, right?
So how did you start to tackle that problem? It's like, hey, Krista, we just started this new team. We're going to build a learning and develop experience for several thousand people. Like, what did you learn from this? How did you tackle the problem?
I learned that I love building programs from scratch. And then I learned it again at Delbrook. But I learned that you can't have all of the answers, and you've got to utilize other folks around you. And in TripAdvisor's case, there were so many amazing HR business partners that were around it for each office around the world, and trying to understand, okay, why are people leaving? Why are people staying? Actually, like, we also want to know that. What are some of the biggest needs? Because those folks are often the folks that were dealing with either department heads or office leaders, and the folks who were coming frustrated, complaining, or even leaving potentially, and trying to fill that gap.
How did you get that feedback at scale? Did you use surveys? How did you do it?
We definitely had surveys, and people did get used to them. I don't think anyone loves surveys. You know, I think it's just one of those necessary evils at times. I think it was more, we would have quarterly business reviews with each of the departments or HR folks, and that would allow us a lot of information. And so you're basically, you know, at this point, it would be a Zoom call, but at that point it wasn't. You know, you're writing as quickly as you possibly can all of the nuggets of wisdom, and then trying to take that information and build out a plan and sharing it out with, I think by the time I left, there were something like 50 HR business partners in the organization.
Wow, that's fantastic. And did you seek out customer feedback as well?
So the product team sought out customer feedback. Some of that information they would give us from an engineering perspective, and some of the engineering training that came in was around the feedback that was received, but that was not on my plate to seek out the customer feedback.
You're at TripAdvisor. It's this well-known growing tech company. You're working on global size problems. What drew you back to construction?
I got a call from Mike Fish, who owns Delbrook, happens to have the same last name as the gentleman I had worked for previously. And he was looking for someone to start a learning and development department. It didn't exist before. And that part was really exciting to me, because in the only two other roles I had, I always had my previous boss to accredit some of the success for. And there was a part of me that wanted to be able to have to chart my own path and show that I could also do it without all of the help of, he's an amazing man, but I also wanted to just be able to put my own stamp on things. And so that was enticing. However, I had the first meeting with Mike, and I was like about 3 months pregnant with our first child. And so after the call, I was like, I don't know where the next 6 months of my life are going to be. I have no idea what it's like to raise a child. So I said to Mike, you know, thank you for the interview, but I'm pregnant, and so it probably isn't the right time. And most recruiters, most CEOs, most leaders would be like, congratulations, see you never. That would probably be maybe the right decision. I don't want to believe that, but it might. But Mike was like, congratulations, but we can totally make that work. And I was so impressed and in awe with his willingness to take a risk on me that I talked with a few other folks, and I said, you know what? He believes in this program so much that I'm excited about it, and I'm willing to take that risk to transition from a global company to a smaller company because of how much of a believer he was. And it was the best decision. One of my mentors was like, that's career suicide. Like, do not leave a global tech company. What are you thinking? Love him. But I was like, I'm doing this. Didn't have to travel I was going to have to travel to Singapore, you know, with probably a 4-month-old at home with my husband. And so I had a chance to not have to do that. But what I also realized in coming back to this industry was how much I love the realness of the people in this industry. And it was a breath of fresh air. I was so excited to be back.
That all speaks volumes of Mike. And we were fortunate to get to talk to Mike Fish on the design development program. And it was cool to really see he is truly passionate about learning and development and building his team. So I think kudos to him for seeing the potential in you and giving you that opportunity. Talk to us about some of the initiatives that you pioneered during your time at Delbrook.
Yeah. So the construction immersion program is the rotation program that exists there, building that out. You know, I think in the first year, we maybe only had two or four SIPs is what we called them, CIP, construction immersion program. And at one point, I think we had like 10 or 11. So it was really, really cool to see and watch these, you know, new folks grow and then get promoted into roles that they were pretty passionate about. Soon, you know, two years in, that was really, really exciting. We built out a program that everyone across the company, whether you were the receptionist or CEO, participated in. It was a full day program to make sure that we were all on the same page with kind of like what it takes from to be a high performing team. We talked through DISC, which is like a behavioral profiling tool, and understanding how you can adapt your communication styles and maybe give an educated guess at what someone else's communication style and how you could adapt yours. And then around how to have some difficult conversations, because we knew that was going to happen both internally. It was going to happen externally. It was happening internally and externally. And so we developed this kind of one day program to share out for all employees.
Love that. And I think difficult conversations, I think just for any individual person is great, but it's especially valuable in the construction industry because there's a lot of stress and confrontation that can come up. You can do everything right and it's still tough to build a building. So you better develop that skill if you want to be successful in the industry.
Yeah. I mean, that's like no different than a marriage, right? Like you can have the best marriage in the world. You're still going to disagree on some things. So you got to be able to have those difficult conversations every once in a while.
Great analogy. Launching Building People. Did you always want to run your own business? Is this something you saw happening? You already talked about your growing family. Like how did Building People come to be?
I did not have this plan. I guess there was a small part of me that maybe always had, there was maybe a little spark in the background that always had an interest or intrigue in starting a business. But in 2019, we had some family things going on and I was spending an hour and a half each way driving to and from work. And I knew that I needed to spend more time at home. And I wasn't sure how long that was going to be, but I just knew that I couldn't be away for as long as I was. And so not knowing that like 3 months later, we would all be home for what felt like indefinitely.
So you launched 3 months before COVID to where we all get sent home to work, right?
Yes. So I was like, I said, okay, I'm going to start my own business, because there was a part of me that was, I loved and still love Del Brooks so much that I didn't want to go and work necessarily for a competitor and just switch companies. I wanted to said, I need to be at home and I need to focus on some things. And so I'm going to start this company, but a little bit selfishly to like, so that I can make sure I can do all these things. And then I could also potentially help some folks. Right. And a very humbling experience. Felt like I have a book that I was just sharing with someone, like the entrepreneur roller coaster ride or whatever that book was. And it truly feels that way, right? And starting
the entrepreneur roller coaster, is that it by Darren Hardy or something different?
Yes, it is. Here it is. But you know, was humbled to be able to get through it and, you know, be on the other side. And then as things progressed from a family perspective, I was able to really focus more on like, what do I really want this business to be? Before it was just like, it was Building People as a name, but it was Krista helping folks with training grants here and there and some freelance learning and development needs.
Yeah, it was like freelance consulting at first is how you first kind of got going.
100%. Like based off of a need and based off of like a personal need and some what seemed to be some client needs.
I often advise people that are struggling with making a big decision or a pivot in their career to consider the cost of inaction. And that's ultimately, I think, how you got over the fear of doing your own thing, is you recognize driving for 3 hours a day and working 8 or more hours a day like was taking too much time away from your family. So the alternative to not starting your business became too painful. The cost of inaction was greater than the risk of taking that leap. What was your first big win? When did you finally think like, I got this? We're off to the races.
I think so. From a training grant perspective, we charge just like a percentage of the training grant, but it has to be paid for externally. And so it has to be paid for out of pocket. It cannot be paid for from the training grant, I shall say. And I think kind of like the fun part about that, or the exciting part about training grants, are that, you know, it takes a couple of months to write. Some can take 4 to 8 weeks to write. And then you sometimes have to wait another 2 months till it gets awarded. So there's a long waiting game. And every single win feels really big and exciting, because we're just like, it becomes, yes, like we were awarded that. That's great. But more importantly, like how excited the client is that all of a sudden now they have $200,000 in training to be able to use for their people. And they are so, so pumped. And truly still, you know, it's been 4 years. We've done almost $5 million, like been awarded almost $5 million in training grants. And every single one, whether it's like $30,000 or $400,000, is just as exciting from that client's perspective, because they're so overjoyed at what they're going to be able to do for their people.
Yeah, it's like Christmas. You're getting somebody else that's investing in your team and your company and your people to help you grow. Like, that's a pretty good feeling.
Yes.
Doing great work. I see something that you talk about, the Thriving Teams Roadmap Facilitator. What is that?
Yeah. So in working with a lot of these small and medium-sized businesses, we have found that, you know, some of them are obviously the clients that are able to sign on with us. That's great. They can see the value. But then there's others that maybe can't afford it, or they have someone already in place in an HR role, maybe a learning and development role, but more than likely an HR role or an office manager role. And they're like, you know what? We need to focus on the culture, the learning and development side of things. But once again, we don't even know where to begin. And that person is often spending most of their time reacting to the leadership's wants and needs. Whereas this program is trying to build out, hey, here's how you could kind of take a little bit of an initiative and build something out for the company that you can have ownership of, that you can get greenlit from leadership, and ideally that will have a huge impact and value on your overall culture. So we're doing it for those folks, those office managers, maybe executive assistants, operations directors, or HR, newer HR folks.
And are you coming into those types of companies and helping like evaluate like what's their current state of their career, but their team?
Really? Yeah, no, we're having that, like we're every week or every other week, we meet with, there's currently 10 people in the program, and I meet with all 10 of them at once in a group setting to talk through, all right, here's what I need you all to do this week. If we're going to build this out, here's why we're going to do it. Here's some information. Here's some data behind why we would want to do that. Here's an example of what that could look like. Here's some templates and documents and frameworks for you to fill out, or some questions to ask to your folks to be able to gather this information so that they can have the true ownership. I want them to be the ones that are successful. I don't want it to be, oh, building people came in and made this happen. I want it to be, oh, Brianna came in and built out this program and it was amazing.
I like that focus of letting it be theirs, right? That's how you empower people. You let them build something and they're much more likely to see it through to succeed, right? The creation of the program is just one part of it. You got to see that it's complete. It's going to evolve over time and improve. It's a living organism, right?
100%.
What about the importance of creating a career roadmap? We've talked about like investing in them, learning and developing. How important is it? And is it a part of your team services to help a company kind of communicate like what career opportunities lie ahead for their employees?
Yeah, I think there are some folks who are very, very content in their roles, and they maybe are okay. You know, you're going to have folks who are going to want to be the career project manager or even a career APM. And I think that's a good thing to acknowledge that, you know what, like this is kind of my jam. I want to do these tasks. I want to have this responsibility. I want to do it well, but I am not necessarily looking for something else. However, then you're going to have some folks who, maybe it's 10 or 20% of your folks, maybe it's 50%. It's dependent on the culture of the organization and what you're trying to build, that say, I want more. And if I can't get it here, I am most definitely going to go somewhere else. I'll spend a little bit of my time here to get some knowledge, and then I'm going to go somewhere else. And oftentimes those folks, it's painful for them to leave, right? Because you know, as a leader, that they have so much potential within the organization. But if you're not telling them, showing them, and maybe providing them with some stretch opportunities that it can be here and you can make that happen at this organization, then they're going to look elsewhere. And
100% true. Like if you have talent on your team that wants to grow and you're not sharing like what's going on in the company and giving them a vision, if your vision's not big enough for them to see themselves growing it, like they're going to look elsewhere, and they should.
And in some ways, I would hope that a lot of leaders would say, like, there are going to be times where you can't bring everyone with you, and that's okay. I am a big believer in like giving, and so think on Unreasonable Hospitality again, that book I mentioned. Like, how can you make the experience of them leaving just as great, or maybe less, like if it can't be great, as least painful as possible,
right? At least painful as possible. I like that.
Because especially in this industry is small, for better or worse, and I think that there is a huge opportunity for people to come back to organizations if it doesn't work out. Those are considered boomerang employees, right? And those boomerang employees are going to do so much for your organization because they are going to say, hey, I thought the grass was greener. I checked. It's not. So I came back. Don't make, like, stay here. It's really good.
Those are the best employees, right? Those are good.
Yeah.
Advice for companies. I see you have a lot of free resources on buildingpeople.com. Could you share what resources you have available for people that are interested in learning more?
Yeah. So some of the things that we talked about, right, of like onboarding, we've got a nice little checklist for how you could potentially improve your onboarding. We have a document where you can see the amount and grant links to training grants for every state here in the U.S., along with ideally the maximum amount you could request. So if you wanted to try out the training grants and writing those on your own, you have all of the information there. We have a kind of document and kind of checklist or template on how to take the knowledge from what I'll call legacy employees, folks that have been there for a really long time, and how to utilize that and make sure that it's not going away as folks are retiring. And then the last thing that we have is this great checklist for building out a thriving team without an HR department, or maybe even with an HR department of one. And there's a lot of different things to think through. And as you're uncovering that information or gathering that information, you'll realize that there are some opportunities for improvement that you can create ideally right away.
I'm impressed by the positioning, Krista. I love that you have these sound, and I've opened some of these. They are truly valuable resources. The onboarding checklist, the building a thriving team. You already provide a consolidated location for them to figure out all the stuff for the grant. So you're giving this stuff away for free. So if people want to do it themselves, like, go right ahead. But you're there if you're there, someone. And from this podcast, you're absolutely somebody all these companies should consider partnering with. So I applaud that positioning. And something I also wanted to thank you. This was a few years ago. I found the levels of contribution from you. And as somebody that is passionate about creating career roadmaps and giving people infinite upside at H&O, levels of contribution helped us get the language to communicate how to develop skills and grow throughout an engineering career. And at the high level, I'll share these levels of contributions. It's dependent. So when you step into a new company, you are 100% dependent on others to do your job. You don't want to tie your shoe in terms of that business. So your goal is to master your day-to-day and become an extremely valuable resource to those people that are delegating to you while building independent skills. That's the second level. So you move from dependent to independent to through others, and then ultimately strategic. But that language helped us communicate like levels of experience to make sure that as people were getting to each level of their career, they were actually building the skills to be successful at the next level. I think without that, it's a really hard, like engineering, how to engineer a steel building. It's really hard to explain how good somebody is and quantify that expertise without having a language and a framework like that. So thank you.
Yeah. The other thing I'll add briefly is that often if you think of like a graph, right, with a X and Y axes, that dependent to independent, people tend to fly through that. You can see the steady improvement in a person. And once they get to that opportunity to contribute through others, it has the potential to go one of two ways, right? It has the potential to go up, or it has the potential to go down. oftentimes it tends to plateau for a period of time because this is a new experience and people are trying to figure out, how can I contribute through others? How can I do that effectively on my time? But also, how can I show that to the organization? How can I kind of, I don't want to say get credit for, but like, how can folks see the value, the anticipated or assumed value that I'm providing, contributing through others? And there are folks that maybe will just kind of stay at that spot. The problem from that model is that if they are not continuing to contribute through others, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're a manager, right? That means that you are just sharing out. You might be a mentor. You're sharing out knowledge with other departments.
Highly effective, independent contributors.
Yeah. That if you aren't perceived as contributing through others, then, or if you continue to be like status quo, the perception is that you are not contributing as well.
The other challenge I see at that career plateau, and you mentioned, like, and I would say anyone that is really engaged and loves what they do at the project management level or design level, like, those are fulfilling, rewarding, well-respected careers, and you should be proud of that. That's perfectly fine. The thing to aware of is, like, how do you make sure that person doesn't get burnt out and gets an understanding? You're also making a decision to maybe cap your earning potential over time. Your earning potential is not going to continue to grow at the rate that it once did, because you're making the decision to stay at this level of your career and not add on new skills or new responsibilities, right? But that's a decision to make.
Yeah. The nice part about this industry is that I think those opportunities and like deciding to cap, you're still doing pretty well. And so it's something that you can live on. And I think it's I think it's amazing when folks realize that they're at a place that they just want to hang out at and like do their best work at, right? And when I think back to my time at TripAdvisor, in terms of like computer engineers, there were a lot of computer engineers that were like, I want to become a manager because that's the next step in my career. And they became managers and they hated it. A lot of business owners, right? They're like, oh, I've got to hire someone so that they can do this thing. I'm going to hire someone that can do this thing. And all of a sudden, they're 5 years into their business, 10 years into their business. And they're like, all the things I started this business because I love doing, I'm not doing anymore because I hired them away. Right. And the same thing with managers. If you're managing, you don't have always the opportunity to do the things that you loved. It's when at TripAdvisor, we created a separate career path. Those that wanted to grow into management and those that just wanted to grow their expertise in computer engineering. And so there was different types of platforms. I'm trying to remember what some of them were called, and it's escaping me. But they then became the internal experts, and they were very much contributing through others by teaching and providing insight and expertise into those different platforms.
It's a great conversation to wrap up today's conversation on design development, building a career roadmap, a thriving teams roadmap. Those are something every business should be thinking about. So tune into Chris's content. Visit buildingpeople.com to gain more insights and resources. Krista, thank you so much for joining us today. I wish you and the team at Building People nothing but continued success. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into Design Development. Real quick before you leave, our goal is to help as many people as possible. We're a growing community and you're a big part of it. So just click that send button, send this episode to a friend, let them get those same insights that you got today. We appreciate you. See you next time.